on side, or rather tape four, side one. We left off, you were talking about your first experiments in Dr. Ike Bush's lab, and you were saying that an article came out of that, a very important article, right?
It's just one of the articles. I don't think it's the best article. Right. It's about molecular evolution of a multi-gene family called corin. It's a protein called the egg shelf. And, it's a multi-gene family, means that there are more than a dozen genes are closely related, but they are so-called developmentally regulated. Mm-hmm. But the research I was involved and during my rotation is determine the sequence of individual genes by DNA sequencing. That was before the automatic DNA sequence was invented, and we have to do the sequence manually, and that's one thing I did pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And once determined DNA sequencing, then by comparing DNA sequencing, we can determine how that whole family of genes were co-evolved during evolution, compared to sequence variations. And so we made a pretty good paper on this, on the topic of gene conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't think I understand very well what project was, and in terms of its interpretations, even though I knew pretty well what I supposed to do on the bench, just make all the subclones and make DNA prep, make a single strand DNA, and conduct DNA sequencing. So that part is no problem. I can carry out all by myself. And so at the end, when I finished the project, Tom was pretty surprised at how much I said it was completed.
Yeah.
And he said one thing, that this guy actually in one shot of cloning and finished to someone, normally would take like at least 2 weeks to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was a very productive rotation. The short part is just like every junior student in the beginning, or first year graduate in the beginning, I don't think I understand very well. I didn't think a whole lot. It's more of just doing it rather than thinking about this one.
Mm-hmm.
And so luckily, working with somebody with Tom made a whole lot of difference, not only just for that project, but also in the next 4 years, was that Tom had a relatively small lab, only five or six of us, including one technician himself, and one undergraduate assistant, and then three graduate students. There was no poster.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that I can have a lot of his time, or among three of us grad students, whoever has more result, get more time from from him. And that's the one thing I keep on telling the students nowadays, is to try to get as much time as possible to directly contact, discuss, and interact with your faculty and professors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most beneficial thing a student can do. They know a whole lot more, and they care a whole lot more than anyone else about your research.
Yeah.
And then stick your hand on your own desk on the bench is absolutely not the right way to do it. You have to find a way to interact with your professors as much as possible to get the most out of it.
Right.
And that's one thing Tom did a lot, and I think I wrote that in my introduction of my thesis. It's for someone like Tom, and it really made a difference to me. So once in my English was not that good time in terms of communicate, and I was uncertain about my scientific ability, and so I need some encouragement. If I encounter a faculty and he himself is very quiet and not very interactive, that I could misinterpret as I was not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be misinterpretation. And my time was not like that. It's very outgoing and very interactive. And we had a lot in the conversations in the daytime and sometimes the evening. And I remember early days, he still come back to lab in the evening and writing something. We would talk a lot. The one thing I still remember early on is for some reason, he doesn't like to wear his shoes in the lab. Yeah, he would take his shoes off and wear his socks and walking between the lab and the office. Yeah, I don't know if he's still doing that or not nowadays, but that's what one thing I do remember.
Oh, yeah.
And we have a board outside the lab, and we use a lot and when we discuss. So that's one of the first things, and when I set my own lab, is have a board outside, so I can, like this one, and outside the lab or anywhere in the lab, outside the lab, in the hallway in my office. So that whenever I talk with people and they have something I can draw, and that's the place, and we had a lot of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was very encouraging to me and extremely beneficial to me as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And how did you get along with other people in the lab? It's a fairly small lab.
Very small lab. We get along very well. And I think probably Tom played a major role in having lab like that. And for example, and I still inherited his tradition that every summer, and he would have a summer party in his backyard, pretty big backyard, that we play the volleyball or badminton or even softball.
Right.
And every summer and every Christmas. And so we had at least two parties or gathering in his house every year. And we also have a chance to go out together for meetings. Only if we don't include undergraduate help, we only have like five of us. So one minivan is enough to carry all of us go to a meeting together. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. And then we went to meeting locally, as well as one time we drove all the way to Boston, and the whole lab in one van to Boston for a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So that really brought the closeness among the few of us. And only three of us plus a technician. And so plus Tom, five of us, and we interacted very closely.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, is your soon-to-be, well, your wife-to-be, is she in another lab then at this time?
Right, and we're in the same class, in the same department. And we're rotating through, and she entered a different lab and for her research project. And that was Dr. Bob Anger. And he was the one actually served as my first-year advisor.
Mm-hmm.
She was the one telling people that I knew exactly what I was doing, even though I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so we spent next 5 years actually in the same building and together, and the in and out same time, and that was a great time.
Right.
And that was one of the most productive time of my career as well as my personal life. And we were very simple, single-minded.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to characterize. And the people always asking nowadays, and how come the early class of Caspia student end up with so successful in terms of the career development? It probably is fact, because each class, we end up with like 50 of us come to United States, entering different graduate program around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot what's the last number, but at least more than half of us and has been continued doing the basic research and conducted the very successful, very productive graduate studies as well as postdoc researches, and move on to take independent assistant professorship in various good and decent or prestigious university around the country. So the ratio is extremely high, and it's probably higher than any other classes, and we have been heard of it. So people are always wondering why we're doing so well. And my simple answer is, when we first came here, we didn't know a whole lot, what else can be. And we are very narrow-minded or very focused,
right.
Depending on how you say it.
Yeah.
And all we want is working hard, studying hard, and the publish good papers, and move on to good research, and as a postdoc, and then go back to China to serve the country. So we never sought this alternative other than doing the lab research. And that's why in the first 5 years, my wife and I, we had such a simple and enjoying life.
Right.
And there's nothing else. And they're just doing the research, and on the weekend, and have later sleep, and get up, go to lab again.
Right.
And worked very hard, and pretty much 7 days a week, minimally 6 nights in the lab, and for the 5 years, we didn't have kids, so just two of us.
Right.
We both work, and then.
And when do you marry? Are you married at this point?
Yeah, we met when we first got there, and. 1984, we married in the Christmas of 1985,
mm-hmm.
when her mother was within the United States. So we took that opportunity to get married. And but since starting from 1984, we started living together. And then in and out of the lab, and always on the same schedule.
Right.
Until we had our first child.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. So how soon after you married did you have your first child?
Not until we graduated.
Okay.
Yeah, that was 1990.
Okay.
Yeah. So for the whole of the 5 years, and the life was easy, simple, very focused.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it has to be very convenient too to be with someone who understands completely, you know, the schedule you have, the sort of the goals you're trying to achieve. That makes me
very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. And not just understand, but and we both are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that was not an issue at all, whether the one would have difficulty understanding why the other would need working so hard.
Yeah. Yeah,
because we are both working on the same boat toward the same goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So, how can I put this? What is your main area of research then? In the Eichbusch lab. How did that evolve? I guess give me a sort of a quick history of that.
Initially, working on, once I joined the lab after my third rotation, and then I returned to the Eichbusch lab. So the first project I was involved is still on the gene regulation of a chorion gene expression during development. That was a sort of a continuation of the project I was doing during the rotation. So that did not working very well, that project, and the gene regulation part. And I was working on this project called determining DNAS hypersensitivity site in the promoter region. So that was the project, and I spent the whole summer of 1985, and plus portion of the fall of 1985, didn't get anywhere, and we now know why. It's because the whole locus, the chromatin was very open. There was no particular site was more sensitive to the DNS digest than any other areas. So what that means is we'll try to use the DNS as a probe to determining at what segment of the promoter region for this multi-gene family is more sensitive, using that as an indication that particular gene is more sensitive or more active in terms of expression. In terms of the whole locus, a big chunk of it was pretty much open. We cannot find any particular area is more sensitive. I think most likely it's the whole family of more than dozen genes are regulated in a very coordinated way, and they're not really differentiated, at least not by the way we were probing it. So that didn't go any well, and we're still working on it. But in the meantime, and the technician, the lab, and I initiated another project, and so that ended with my real thesis. And there was an interesting story behind that. Early on, when the molecular biology just started, and David Hoganis, and then at Stanford, was using this recombinant DNA technology to isolating the gene from Drosophila, and a very well characterized model organism. The first group of genes they were able to put into the plasmid or put in the recombinant fashion was a ribosomal gene. So that's a very abundant gene, very important genes. And the ribosomal gene was one of the first genes being studied at the level of recombinant DNA level. And so one of the side discoveries they made, couldn't understand what's happening back then, was a fraction of ribosomal gene containing an extra piece of DNA. They're very confused and they speculate what might be, but doesn't make any sense. There were two speculations. A, it is an intron, as we learned back then, that the intervening sequence inserted in the middle of a gene. When gene is expressed, the intervening sequence or intron is being spliced out. But that doesn't seem to be fit very well, because and there's only a fraction of this. And then if it's multi-gene family, if they were evolved from a common ancestor, you would expect every gene would have it. But only 20% of gene has that piece of sequence. Then they speculate there might be a mobile element or transposable element. So that doesn't make sense either, because that piece of sequence only go into that one specific area. What we learned back then, the classical definition of a transposable element is jumping around more or less randomly in the whole genome instead of going to a specific area or site. So neither hypothesis seemed to be making any sense. So they didn't pursue that project. So when we were working on the chorion gene, we were working on the chorion gene not from Drosophila, and from another insect species, a sycamore, called the Bombyx mori. And we had a CD at the genomic library made by Tom early on when he was a postdoc. And he also identified the ribosomal gene in his library, the genomic library. And he actually mapped the ribosomal gene, realized that the fraction of the Bombyx or sycamore's ribosomal gene, similar to Drosophila or fruit fly, also contain a bit of extra sequences. So just left there. And without knowing what is related to Drosophila or not, and of course without knowing what it might be. So that's where we picked up on, and since we did the first is just take the sequence and sequence it. What we found is, and yes, it is a ribosomal locus.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a bit of extra sequences there. So we see that the extra bit of sequence is about 5 kilobase in length. But by looking at the sequencing, we realize it's like reverse transcriptors containing retroviruses. That was a little bit of a surprise. And we now know we call the retrotransposable element. But then we just start learning the retroviruses, and that there might be a retrotransposable element. It's a very poorly defined family of transposable element back to 1985 or 1986. Only thing we can recognize is in the middle of it, it contains a coding region, here a sequence homology with a protein called the reverse transcriptase that was first discovered in the retroviruses during the study of oncogene transformation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was provide some new insight as well as new questions. The first, we learned that that bit of sequence is not the intron. By definition, intron doesn't code any sequences, doesn't make any proteins. The very fact that the intervening sequence actually coding for a protein says it's not an intron, so that being ruled out.
Mm-hmm.
And the second, because the homology with the reverse transcriptase, that would automatically lead you to think that bit of a sequence as a mobile genetic element, because retrovirus, here one thing similar to the transposable element is that once infected into human or rodent cells, it inserted randomly in the genome, like the jumping around of a transposable element. So it could be more like a transposable element than intervening sequence. But then we have to ask a question, how come this specific transposable element only go to one place in the whole genome, which never heard before?
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very puzzle. So we had the first paper in 1985, the published sequence reporting that, and this extra sequence in the 20S ribosomal gene encodes a reverse transcriptase-like element. So there were two papers we published, and from the Akbush lab. The next question is, determine the mechanism by which that extra piece of sequence, which we call the R1, ribosomal insertion 1, or R2, ribosomal gene insertion sequence number 2, because they're two different types.
Mm-hmm.
How does R1 or R2 elements inserted in the specific locus? So that become a question. I've been thinking about these ones. And it was a very funny story. I've been thinking and thinking and thinking. I think I can say this. So one day, we went to the bathroom with Tom. We were both standing in the bathroom. I've been thinking this idea for a while. All of a sudden, I just came out of my mouth. I said, Tom, why don't we do an experiment? We were sitting in the bathroom, actually. I said, if we would hypothesizing that this R1 or R2 element, like every other transposable element, also encode an enzyme called endonuclease that would cleave the DNA for insertion in the genome.
Mm-hmm.
All we need is adding one modification to this hypothesis. That is, unlike other transposable element, their endonuclease recognize pretty much random of DNA sequence, depending on where the cut the insert. Also, the endonuclease encoded by R1 or R2 might somehow more behavior like a restriction enzyme. They only recognize one specific sequence. They can only cut one area in the whole genome.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the element is inserted. Of course, that sequence be cut by this sequence-specific endonuclease ought to be in the ribosomal genes. And that was not very straightforward thinking, and it was not easy thinking that way, because A, the restricting enzyme I was using an analogy, and is this restricting enzyme pure from bacteria, I typically recognize between 4 to 7 nucleotide sequence.
Mm-hmm.
If you calculate, and randomly, and any given combination of 4 to 7 nucleotide sequence can occur 100, if not 1,000 times in the genome. But we're talking about inserting only one area in the whole genome which contains a billion base pairs. So if it is indeed a specific endonuclease, it ought to be recognized much longer sequence in the genome, unlike conventional restricting enzyme we know of. So that was never heard of. Secondly, conceptually, that was different from the way we've been learned about the transport spectrum all these years. That's supposed to be jumping around. So now we're saying this atom is only jumping into one area.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the biochemical mechanism was never heard before, but also evolution. How did that happen? Because that was not supposed to be advantageous for the propagation of transport spectrum. Because if you just go to one area, you're eventually being eliminated.
Right.
So that's not a very good way to survive as far as a mobile element, which is a piece of a surface DNA, is concerned. Yeah. But the idea is good because it's testable. If a specific sequence endonucleus, then we can test it easily biochemically by making recombinant protein and just test whether it can behave like other machine enzymes and specifically cleave the ribosomal genes. It's very testable. And
right.
I can come with a very simple strategy, say, and make a plasmid DNA, which would drive the expression of this elusive or hypothetical endonucleus. And in the same plasmid DNA, I would put this ribosomal gene into it that contains insertion site, but without element yet. And hopefully that when this enzyme is expressed in the E. coli, it would be functional and cleave the DNA. We know the plasmid DNA in the cell is circular. If this enzyme is indeed, as we postulated, encode a sequence-specific endonucleus and cleave the ribosomal gene, then it would linearize this plasmid DNA and separate the circular and the linear DNA is quite easy, if that indeed occurred.
Right.
Yeah. So that was the whole idea behind this. And I remember Tom Kuhn saying this when we walk out of the bathroom. A few minutes later, he said, let's do it. I said, it's a great idea. So he was really thinking about this one. So he actually agreed.
Right.
And so that the next year also, and I just invested my whole energy into working on that idea. I probably, if not a whole year, I did spend like a good 8 or 9 months on the idea. And then nowadays, what I probably can do in a week. At that time, and a lot like PCR technique or cloning technique was not available. And even you just make a construct, and then you design one way, but to make it, there's no easy way to make it if there's no available restriction enzyme site in the area you want to subclone.
Right.
And we have to do all these tedious ways. And then we have to go through a lot since we didn't realize. And it's not as simple as we thought, because I thought it's very simple. If the plasmid is linearized, then it will be degraded. The E. coli cannot grow. So I can do a genetic screen for the plasmid don't grow. But turns out that now we realize it was not the right way of thinking about this, because the E. coli replicated DNA so fast, then it's faster than the way they can degrade it. So even the linearized, and only a small portion at any given time is linearized, but the majority of the plasmid DNA are still circular, and the E. coli bacteria have no problem to continue to grow. Even a small portion of DNA or plasmid DNA is being linearized, and the ampicillin resistance carried by those DNA is being degraded. But that was not a problem for the E. coli growth, which was the way I was initially screening on. So that didn't work. And then we talked to people, and we said, well, we have the more sensitive to acids. So instead of looking for the E. coli growth genetic screen, I was starting doing the biochemical screen, looking for the evidence for DNA linearization. And I spent several months, couldn't get it. One day we're talking to a faculty in the department, he said, the way you extract DNA is not right, because the conventional way of extracting plasmid DNA involving a denaturing agent called SDS, so that would denature everything. So you will not be able to separate. If there's a DNA linearized in the E. coli cells, you could not detect it. So you got to find a way to do this once. Then I said, oh boy, that must be the reason. So if there was a DNA being cleaved by this putative endonucleus, the method I was using would not allow me to detect it.
Right.
Then I modified the method and adopted the so-called the mild extraction method, allowing presumably isolation of both the linearized DNA as well as the supercoiled DNA. And then, boy, that was lucky. And after all this, I actually remember how the discovery was made, and it was a Friday. And then I looked at my gel. I see a nice, very nice linear bend there. And that's exactly what we've been predicted and we've been dreaming for. And that's the first time. That's for the first time I really tasted what feeling of making discovery.
Right.
For the whole weekend, I couldn't sleep and I was so excited and I get so exhausted, both myself and my wife. Because she probably been just dragged by me and looking for this endonucleus, endonucleus, endonucleus for the past 8 or 9 months. And finally we got it. And then whole weekend, actually it was pretty cool. I didn't tell anybody, just except my wife. So by the Sunday, I think, and I'm pretty much convinced myself. Then what I did, Sunday night, and pretty late before I left the lab, I just take a piece of paper towel and wrote a note and on my desk to Tom. And I wrote, Tom, I got it. So I come to the lab pretty late, and after 11, so Tom come pretty early, and like 7:30.
Mm-hmm.
So he was yelling me later. He said, "You just got me crazy for the whole morning without knowing what you got." Of course, he know what I was doing,
right.
But he couldn't believe I actually got that one because there was no sign.
Mm-hmm.
Because that weekend, and anything was working. It's just working because all of a sudden the evidence just sitting there. There was no other interpretations. It's pretty simple.
Right.
And you got it. You got it. Yeah. So he was walking in the back and out and in and out the lab. And so when I come in, he said, "What did you get?" I said, "Yeah, I got the endonucleus."
Did he fall over?
Yeah, then he came on telling a story to all other students in the subsequent years. And he said, that's how he got it. He was cool. I said, "Well, yeah, I was cool, but you didn't know and how exotic I was the whole week."
Exactly.
And, because I want to make sure I was not making things up and I was not misinterpreting my result. Mm-hmm. It was a real discovery here. Yeah. That was really exciting, the part, yeah. And so when, at that point, then things become much easier. Once got activity, then acid is very easy. And within a few months, and we submit a paper. So that was published in the Cell.
Mm-hmm.
And a few months later, without much revision at all, and it just went in pretty straightforward.
Wow.
And it carries a number of implications. A, we established a system to study the transposable element. And B, and that was a time, and people start realizing that reverse transcriptors containing mobile element is much bigger than previous realized. Because previous, when Barbara McClintock discovered the transposable element 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
was so-called DNA-based mobile element, which go from DNA to DNA to DNA. So this is a different class. And like retroviruses, and for a while, people thinking this is probably a deviated group, a sub-branch. Now it turns out that all the way from mammalian cells to the east, and the retro transposable element, as we call it now, which stands for reverse transcriptors containing transposable element,
mm-hmm.
represent a much big portion than we realize.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in mammalian cells, it represents more than 10% of the whole genome.
Mm-hmm.
It is the biggest group of transposable element. The mechanism by which they propagate was unknown. And so we were the first one to provide a system to studying how they integrate. And the second, that changed the concept of transposable element can only go to goes to randomly. And it says, well, and the mobile element can actually insert specifically into one area.
Mm-hmm.
And the probably most important aspect is providing an assay to for the subsequent study of not only the integration step, but also the reverse transcription step.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, we're actually able to express a functional enzyme in the E. coli. So once you have a functional enzyme, then you don't have to deal with DNA anymore. You have an enzyme, you can study the enzyme
mm-hmm.
biochemically. So that led to the later finding after I left and the further characterization of the reverse transcriptors encoded by the R2 element. And from that on, Tom's lab was never go back studying current gene. The whole lab shifted.
Yeah.
Studying this one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So now the Tom Ekbush lab now is a leading expert in the field of transposable element.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you that made up, by the way, the bulk of your dissertation, right? Your PhD.
That's only one chapter, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What were they?
I was pretty productive when I was a graduate student. I probably did 10 papers.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, in the grad studies and then. So Tom was trying to set a record and see what anyone in the department can break my record. Not so far. Right. So that was one project, and then I was involved in the number of related projects and determining how many other elements like R1 or R2 in other organisms,
mm-hmm.
and studying how they were evolved. And a major separate project was studying the molecular evolution of reverse transcriptors element containing transposable element, because I start realizing more and more so that R1 and R2 was not as special as we thought in the first place. Mm-hmm. We thought this must be some weird transposable element, happened to be containing reverse transcript for some unknown reason, and does not necessarily representing a mainstream of transposable element as we want to call it. But then we realized that the more paper comes out and the more sequences we conducted, realized that it's a whole lot broader than we thought. Then I was involved in conducting a sequence comparison and the molecular evolutionary analysis of reverse transcripts containing genes. At the beginning it was very easy, and I remember the first version of the paper I came up with only contained 16 sequences.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to align them with my eye and hand instead of a computer program. That was not even available back then. And so align the 16 sequences together, and I calculate the sequence similarity pairwise, and first with second, and the second with second, the third, blah, blah, blah. It's doable with calculator.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is impossible, right? And so that was the time when the computer program was not available. So actually, after comparing the sequence, aligned them, and we realized one thing. There's a very good correlation between the protein sequence similarity in the reverse transcript region and the overall structure of reverse transcript containing region. It sounds like a little vague. So what that means is that by looking the sequence, we can tell that when the element, when the transpose pattern evolve, they evolve from very simple form and they become more and more complicated, more and more sophisticated. The most sophisticated one being the HIV virus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The most primitive one is the one discovered in the bacteria. And the people was confused and they was not clear how they related. And we were among the first, I think we were the only one doing that at the time, and compare the sequence homology of one protein, that's a reverse transcriptase, which we determined that is the only thing common for this totally different element, a very divergent element. But by analyzing the reverse transcriptase, we can conclude they were evolved evolutionary from the same common ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
So we can trace them back, how they evolved. And we can also conclude that as the structure change and become more and more sophisticated, the protein sequence also change along the way. And so we were able to draw an evolutionary tree and conclude that reverse transcripts containing retroviruses, which is much more common studied, much more extensively studied than retro transposable element.
Mm-hmm.
It only represents a small branch of whole reverse transcripts containing element. The bigger group is the one actually don't contain a structure called the LTR that's common to all the retroviruses. LTR is very important element necessary for retrovirus or HIV to replicate, to integrate, and to infect. Okay, so we were able to conclude from our analysis that there is a bigger and the more primitive group of transposable element. They like retrovirus, but they don't contain this LTR. So that would argue that there must be a new mechanism out there. So eventually it was elucidated out right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we now know that so-called non-LTR element, as we initially named, actually is a much bigger group and than we realized 10 years ago.
Right.
Yeah. So that actually had some other additional impact on me, that part of research, in addition to the molecular biology study on the nucleus, because that gave me a training on the molecular evolution, and so let me give me the ability and the perspective be able to more appreciative for the genome-wide studies, because when the genome studies, and it's a book of a whole lot of information come out, it's a raw information without analyzing. Just dumping the gene bank in the database.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't not know how to analyze, if you don't appreciate sequence alignment, sequence comparison, you're not being able to take the full advantage of the information available to you. And so because of the early trainings and not being following that one, even though I was not really starting the genomic project or genome project, but I was able to follow it and appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons nowadays let me think about we should move into the proteomic studies of the completion of the genome project. And
right.
I think there's a trace back to my early training on that subject.
Hmm.
Because Tom Ekpoh himself has a very solid training in the molecular region. He's very interested, and his lab continue working on that part. And if not for that, I would not be supervised into that areas of research.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually has some very good influence on me in terms of being able to appreciate from a large scale from a different perspective. Because the molecular biology in the end, the more you do, become more narrowly focused.
Yeah.
Not being able to appreciate it from the whole genome-wise, from evolutionary standard. Instead, you're focusing on one protein, one cell, and one organism. But evolutionary studies emphasize a comparison between the organism and during the distance, during the evolution. So that puts you in a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that is not something that everybody had similar training during the graduate study, have two different aspects. They're pretty separate. Not many people I know of, and they're doing both evolutionary study as well as molecular studies at the same time.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. Were there any other work then that went into the PhD?
That's the two major areas I was involved. Yeah.
Okay, good. So by 1989 then, you received your PhD.
Right.
And at that time, what were your thoughts about where you would pursue a postdoc? Was it obvious that you would continue on in the Eichbusch?
No, that was very confused for several months. And a lot of things happened in 1989 politically, and it affected my career.
Right.
Because the first thing, we don't know where we can go. Because we come to the United States on a so-called J-1 visa, and there's a requirement that if you come to study on the J-1 visa, American government is responsible to limit your post-grad study to no more than 18 months. Hmm. After that, you have to return to your home country to serve for minimum 2 years before you can return to the United States to work.
Right.
So that's called the J-1 requirement. And the only exception is in your home country waived the requirement. And we come here, and we all hope one day we can return to China to serve the country. And that's what the country was, the government wanted us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped us to apply and to train, set up the English training, and they helped us to fly here. And so that was the goal and early on. But in 1989, a lot of things happened. And one of the major dramatic events was the Tiananmen Massacre.
Right.
And that changed my view a lot. Okay. And until 1988, I was still determined, and if I can get a chance to do a postdoc research, after that, I still want to go back to China to do the research in China,
mm-hmm.
to serve my country. But the Tiananmen Massacre and the changed things quite a bit. I just can't believe they can kill people like that. And, so we were very, very angry, mad, and I remember June 4th, and we attend a rally and in Washington, D.C. We drove all the way through there and then come back to Rochester. And for 36 hours, nonstop, I couldn't sleep and pretty upset.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, things calmed down somewhat. And then we start thinking about what we want to do. And then we're thinking about to go to Canada for research, thinking about staying in the United States. And then one thing happened, late 1989, was the President Bush issued the executive order and to waive the requirement for all the J-1 Chinese students to return to China.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's the only reason we can do it, and the immigration service cannot do it. But that was initiated at the White House
mm-hmm.
by the President Bush. So they said, we're not requiring you to return to China unless you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was specific reason behind that, because we were so angry, and a lot of us and the opening protested, and we actually yelled in front of the Chinese embassy for the whole day.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard to take a video, take a picture of that one, but we can care less at the time.
Yeah.
We're so angry. And so there is a real possibility that if we would return, depending on what attempts for you in the next few years, then you keep on going backwards of the communist, the rigorous control, and then we could face a prosecution.
Yeah.
So that was not making, that's a real possibility. That's the first time I actually protest and the Communist Party. And that's just unbelievable. I don't see how can they kill people like that. And I mean, they could turn the whole thing around in much better ways. I mean,
yeah.
Yes, and I agree. The country needs to be stabilized, and we cannot afford to go back to another chaotic cultural revolution like a period. But there must be another way to deal with the situation. You don't have to use a tank and crush the student.
No,
you
right.
can just negotiate with the student, and because at the early on, at least, they were not asking a whole lot. They're not asking a whole lot. I don't think a student will want to throw in throughout the communist control or government. I don't think that's what they wanted.
No, they just wanted recognition.
I think that's what government really accused and got them angry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what the intention. I think now the leadership of the Communist Party now started admitting that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they made a few bad mistakes and then it escalated. And by the time.
Yeah, it escalated and then become almost out of control.
Yeah.
And both parties, the student was really angry, understandably, they're young. And so it is, I think, a large responsibility of the leadership, and you got to recognize that once, and don't take the hardship, and not moving like tens of thousands of army into the city. I just never heard about this because I still pretty recent that part. And otherwise, and I had a lot of respect for Deng Xiaoping and all he did for reforming the country. But that part, I don't think I could agree with him. I think he could do differently. I think he should have done this differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So after 1989 and after the Bush executive order, and we all of a sudden have the opportunity to stay in the United States to continue our research. And then I got into thinking about this, what I want to do. And so one of the first things I want to do is go to the Dr. Health Wellness Lab to do the postdoc.
Right.
And he was doing the reverse retrovirus for years. And so that's very logical. And once I realized I could have opportunity to do my postdoc research in the United States, and I wrote a letter application to him right away. And a few days later, he called back to Tom Eckbush and asked him how I was doing. And he actually read my paper, and he knew what I've been doing as a grad student, even though we never met in person. So he invited me for an interview right away at UCSF. And the interview did not turn out very well, though. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do very well on the interview part, because somehow I put the two interviews together. And also interviews with another faculty at UCSF and Cynthia Canyon, working on the C. elegans development. I was more into the C. elegans stuff, but also interested in the history study, the history part of Obama's lab. So I want to know what he's doing currently. And then I came up away with the impression the research in the Obama's lab is not as active as early on.
Mm-hmm.
And those oncogene days are over. And again, getting more and more into the tumor suppressor field in terms of cancer research, and he's continued working on the retrovirus part. I was just not very excited by his current research at the time.
Mm.
And I had a lot of respect to him, and we went to lunch together. That was only 2 months after he just received the Nobel Prize. Yeah. So I remember asking him, I said, Dr. Vamos, how do you feel about the Nobel Prize? He said, surprised. So he wanted to buy me lunch, and then I made a joke. I said, yeah, and you're now rich, man, you can buy me a lunch.
I know.
Yeah, and so we had a very good beginning, but at the end, and they just, and I somehow just, I was not very excited.
Right.
And I was not very good to behave either at the time. And so when I was not excited, I must somehow just shoot off.
Yeah.
I didn't even go to dinner with his lab. Instead, I went to dinner with Cynthia Canyon's lab.
Right.
And that created a very bad impression, because he was the one inviting me to go there, and I didn't really show much enthusiasm. Yeah. So when I came back, he wrote a letter and to me, said, and although you're on the top of my list, so I decided to offer someone else. So I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of my behavior during that interview. So in the meantime, I also interviewed a number of other places, and I think I applied for 10 different labs as a postdoc research.
Oh, yeah.
I was more or less accepted by at least 7 or 8 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So my final decision was narrowed down between David Beach at the Cold Spring Art Lab, working on the cell cycle control, and Matt Scott at Stanford, working on the Drosophila development. And that was a hard choice between these two. And I went to Boulder, interview with Matt Scott, and he was at the time just about moved to Stanford, joined the faculty at Stanford. I mean, I really want to go to California, and I read the history of Stanford. I was so much into this once.
Right.
And also, Matt was such a nice person. He really wanted me to join his group.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a terrific interview with him at the Boulder. And then has a very positive interaction with a lot of people in his lab. And with him especially. He actually invited me to stay in his house.
Wow.
And so the day I was leaving, they actually left earlier and go to the vacation. So that's okay. So the limo is going to pick you up a few hours later. Why don't you stay? This is your house. And they just drop the key back when you leave it. We're pretty close. I like him a lot.
Yeah.
The only difficulty I had was I don't know the Drosophila genetics.
Yeah.
I feared that it take a long time to learn the Drosophila genetics. And it's not something I can learn so quickly. And I was really reluctant. And I just don't know what I'm getting into it.
Right.
Whereas when I was into with David Beach, and very straightforward, that was a good time. And the sales cycle just become emerging as a major breakthrough is about to happen. And that was a year that discovered cycling proteins
right.
as a major regulator of cell cycle. And I think that's the time when I was interviewing with David. His lab made a discovery that cycling function by physically compressed with the CDC2 protein. And that was before cycling-dependent kinase concept was developed. But the realization that it is two proteins, A is kinase, and the cycling need to be complex, was the seed of the idea of CDK later.
Right.
So a lot of excitement going on, and he was just awarded Howard Hughes investigator positions. The lab was expanding, so interview went very well, and before he even left, and he offered me a position, and promised that he can help my the immigration if that needed, and I'll be appointed as a Howard Hughes research associate, which means a regular postdoc, but better than regular postdoc in terms of a benefit.
Right.
And he likes him a lot, and it all clicked and almost right away.
Okay. Let's just leave it right there for now.
Okay.
I'll turn it over.
Okay.